Okay, so I'm going to get going now with it because I've got a lot of there's a lot to cover and there's not so much time. I do want to start the session with a set-aside prayer. This is something I heard a lot of speakers say before they speak, and I really resonated with it. And so I'm going to say it. If anyone wants to say it in the background, we can't hear you, but you can say it along with me. Dear God, please set aside anything I think I know about myself, about my disease, about the big book, about the 12 steps, about the program, about the fellowship, about the people in the fellowship, and all spiritual terms, especially you, God, so that I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help me to see the truth. Amen. Okay, so welcome to the Big Book Workshop. My name is Daniel UK. I'm a sexaholic. In the next 4 weeks, we will be taking the 12 steps as outlined in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to recover from sexaholism. We will be solely relying on the recipe in this book. If we follow the recipe in this book, you are guaranteed to be free from sexaholism. That's a guarantee that the book gives. What that means is that we are guaranteed to have the compulsion to lust removed. And that's what's happened to me as a result of going through these steps. Now, whether you're a newcomer to the program or you have double-digit sobriety, I encourage you to have an open mind. This is the way that they went through the steps in the early 40s. I got this workshop through someone called Paul F., who's been in the program for over 30 years. And he was taught by his sponsor, who was taught by someone who was in the early 40s, and the way to work the steps. I'll give you a little bit background quickly about me. I've been in the program for a little while now, and I struggled. I struggled. I was a what's known as a frequent relapser, and I just couldn't get it. I was going to meetings. I was on the calls. I had a sponsor. I was trying to work the steps, and I just kept falling. I was reading the book. I was surrendering. I was praying. And no matter what I tried, I just couldn't stay sober. My disease took me to crazy, crazy places in terms of lusting. I would do anything to lust. One particular event was in my parents' in-law's house. I was just married, and I was sitting in their living room. They've got an open-plan house in America, as they all do, and it was 12 o'clock at night. I'm sitting there by myself. They got a huge flat-screen TV, and I'm watching porn. And my brain is telling me, Daniel, are you crazy? Anybody can walk out of their bedroom and see you watching the porn. It could be my wife, my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law, my mother-in-law, my father-in-law. Anyone can come out. And I could not stop. I was powerless. I had no way of, I couldn't move away from the screen. And many of these types of occurrences happened, and I just couldn't understand it. And no matter how much I tried to stop, no matter how much I said I'm never going to do this again, I just kept falling. And I was so frustrated. And I know that there are people on this call that can relate to that. And some people on the call may say, that's exactly what I'm going through right now. Well, I could tell you that I've been there, and I've come out the other end, and it's incredible. And the only thing I can say is, at one point, I don't know why it was at this point, but at one point I finished acting out, I finished watching porn, and it was the daytime, and I was supposed to be working, and I just didn't care to work. I was just finished acting out. I felt the usual feeling of just completely feeling terrible and remorseful. I felt sickened by it. I went downstairs. I went onto the. I'm going to finish with this because I've got to get through the material. But I was on the floor and I was in tears. And although it wasn't the first time, it was many times that I cried. But this time I just literally went on my hands and knees. I had been through the program. I'd gone through the steps. And I begged Hashem. I begged him, please take this away from me. Help me. And it was the same moment. that I felt such pain that suddenly I had a spiritual awakening, and something happened where I just sort of stood up and I kind of got a hold of myself, and I realized that the reason why I keep acting out is because I keep trying to get better, and I can't get better. I can't. It's not about me. It's, in fact, the problem was always me. The problem has always been me. I am literally self-centered to the extreme. That's how I've been for 30 years of my life. I've been self-centered to the extreme. And I grabbed hold of the big book, and I went through it, and I realized that this is what I was missing, is that it's not about me anymore. It's about giving. It's about just giving to others, giving over to my wife, giving to my children, giving to the community, giving to God. And that same day, I heard a workshop by Paul F., which is what this workshop is based on, and I've not looked back. I'm sober, and I'm not just sober, but I'm a free man, and I have my marriage is got so much better. My relationship with my children, my business is everything has changed. So enough about me, because I'm focusing too much on me now. Let's get straight into the program. So if we turn to page XXVII, I recommend everyone get a hold of a big book, a copy of the big book, so that you can follow along. I highlighted everything that I'm going to be mentioning today, and I'd recommend to highlight the paragraphs that I do mention so that you can go over them. So page XXVII in the fourth edition. The big book, the author of the big book, make it very clear that this is a physical craving. It's a physical craving. We're going to see that there's a physical aspect to this disease and there's a mental aspect to this disease. On the last line of XXVII, it says, of course, a sexaholic, I'm going to change the words alcoholic to sexaholic. Of course, a sexaholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for lust. And this often so we see from here that the doctor's opinion, the doctor is saying this is a physical craving. And if you look also on page XXIX, it says, hold on 1 second. Page XXIX, it says that they lusted, hold on 1 second, after they have succumbed to the desire again. No, sorry, at the bottom of XXIX, it says they took a drink, or they lusted, that day, a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests. In other words, what he's saying here is that we have to take lust in order for the craving to be there. I cannot crave lust unless lust is in me. It's very important to keep that in mind. There's a physical aspect to this. The craving is a physical aspect. Page XXVI, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to sexualism interests us. So we see here, and there's other places as well, again, XXX, it says the phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. So this is an allergy that we have. It's an abnormal reaction to lust. I have an abnormal reaction to lust. I have to get it out of my head that I'm being a bad person. It's not a matter of being bad or good. This is a sickness. This is an allergy that I have. It's no different to if I went to the doctor and the doctor said that I've got diabetes and I have to take my insulin, otherwise I'll die. This is exactly the same situation. I have a disease that will kill me if I don't take my medicine. And the recipe in this book is my medicine. Now, one of the things that I learned from Paul F. was that we should take statements in the book and turn them into questions. So the first question that I have to ask myself is, do I have an abnormal reaction to lust? See, it might be that you might not be a sexaholic. You might just be a person who, you know, who likes to look at naked girls online and masturbate. That's a lot of people do that. And I questioned myself in the program whether, well, maybe I'm not a sexaholic. Maybe I'm just somebody, a regular guy, who gets excitement and enjoyment from acting out, from masturbating. So the authors are making it very clear. If you're a sexaholic, then you have an abnormal reaction to lust. You can't stop. You cannot control it. So the question I have to ask myself is, do I have an abnormal reaction to lust? You know, for me, sitting in my parents-in-law's living room with open-plan house with a widescreen TV, or taking my wife's phone, her mobile phone, and lying down in bed next to her and watching porn when she can easily, you know, find out, and I could end up divorced with three children, and other crazy things that I've done, I believe that I have an abnormal reaction to lust, and therefore I'm a real sexaholic. Now, the other thing that the authors describe is what we know as RID. So if we look at page XXVIII, so XXVIII at the bottom, two lines from the bottom, it says that they are restless, irritable, and discontented. So we see that unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. So what the authors are saying here is that the reason why I'm feeling the need to go and act out is there's a deeper reason here. It's because I'm feeling restless, irritable, or discontented. Something's bothering me. There's something deeper to the problem. And so basically, unless I find something that substitutes lust, I'm going to keep grabbing hold of lust. This is my blanket. This has been my pacifier, or my dummy if you're in the UK. This has been what I use to drug myself up so I don't have those negative feelings. So I need to find a substitute for lust. You see, what I've seen in this program is that there are a lot of guys who come in, and when they get a bit of sobriety, they're what's called, the book calls, a dry drunk. So they haven't acted out, but they're miserable. And they're just feeling terrible. And I felt that. I remember the first, you know, the first stage of my sobriety was horrifyingly painful because I had no drug to ease my pain, and I had all these raw feelings that I just couldn't deal with, and in fact they were more acute because of the fact that I didn't have my drug for a while, and now I'm really, really feeling those negative feelings. So it's not enough just to be free of lust, because I won't last. I have to have something. There's something that needs to be substituted. We're going to find out what that is. I just also want to mention the idea of a spree. You know, when I said that I had acted out over and over again, the big book tells us about it. It's what's known as a spree. On page XXIX, it says, it says that after they had succumbed, after they had succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving, the big book saying, the author's telling us about the craving, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to lust again. God, that's my life right there. Right, I succumb to the desire. I have a pain that I need to numb the pain. So I go, and because I've got lust in my body, I've got a craving, and because I've got a craving, I have no way of being able to physically to stop myself. I'm craving it. I have to have it, and therefore I pass through the well-known stages of a spree, which means I just suddenly go on a binge. I don't know if anyone else can relate to this. I'm sure you can. I literally would go days. I could not go 24 hours without masturbating at some point. It was like a rolling masturbation session. I couldn't stop. And then, of course, I would emerge remorseful. So I'd feel crap about the fact that I just acted out. And because of that, of course, then I feel terrible. I feel self-pity. And that feeds my craving again to go and lust out because I need my drug. And so then I go and I take the drug again, and of course the cycle continues. And of course, I've got a firm resolution never to lust again. How many times have I promised myself, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it again. And never, it never worked. And it says this is repeated over and over again. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Here, the big book is giving us the first clue to the solution. The solution is an entire psychic change. What is a psychic change? So psychic change means that there needs to be a change in the way that I think. Psychic is mental. It means I need to change something in my mind. It's not that I need to get filters necessarily, although that helps. But that's not what's going to help. That's not what's going to actually solve the problem. There's something that needs to change in my mind. Now, the question I ask myself is, at this point, is do I have the power to do that? Do I have the power to change my mind? And therefore, I'll solve the problem. Well, if I was capable of doing that, then what am I doing here on this call with you? What am I doing going to meetings? What am I doing working these steps and working this program? If I could just change my thinking, then I would have done it a long time ago. Are you willing to consider that unless you experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of recovery? This is what the big book is saying, that there has to be a psychic change. It says on page XXIX, towards the middle of the page, the end of the line, it says, one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. So there's my answer. In other words, I can't produce that psychic change. Yes, I need to change. My mind needs to change. But the authors of the big book are saying, hold on there, Charlie. You're not going to do it. You can't change your mind. It has to be something more than human power to produce the essential psychic change, in which we know it's God. God can only create that change. And so, again, I can ask myself the question. I've got a sponsor. Can you ask yourself the question? Can your sponsor produce that psychic change for you? Can your wife produce that psychic change for you? Can your children? Can money? Are you willing to believe that nothing human can make this happen? And this is what the whole essence of step one, and this is why step one, that the authors spend half of the book on step one. Why? They've got 12 steps to go through, and they spend half of the entire book on step one. Why? Because unless I get it in my thick brain that I'm completely powerless, meaning I have absolutely no way of getting better without God. And not just me, nobody human, no human power, not my sponsor, not my wife, not my children. I used to think my sponsor was God. I thought, oh my God, I've got to get a great sponsor. It was amazing. I remember the first time that someone said to me, I need to get a sponsor. I said, oh great, okay, here we go. And now it's interview time. Ta-da, you know, let's get the CVs out, right? Who's got the longest sobriety? Well, he's got to be Jewish as well because, you know, I've got to relate to the guy. He's got to be married with children. He's got to be, it's like I'm picking a wife or something, right? But my sponsor's not going to keep me sober. That's ridiculous. No human power is going to keep me sober. And telling my wife about my disease is not going to get me sober either. She's not going to be able to help me. Am I willing to believe that nothing human can make this happen? Now, if we go to page 11, if we turn to page 11, and we go to paragraph 4. Now, a little intro here. Basically, Bill is in his kitchen. He's drinking gin. And his friend Ebby comes to visit him. He hasn't seen Ebby in a long time, many years, and he certainly hasn't seen him sober. The last time he saw Ebby was drunk, and they had been drinking buddies. So Ebby comes in, and he's sober. And it's incredible because when Bill sees him, he sees that Eddie is a different person. He looks different. His face is radiating. And he's a bit curious. So he offers him a drink. And of course, Eddie turns down the drink. And Bill's just like gobsmacked, like, what's going on over here? And here's a very important line in the Big Book. Again, page 11, towards the bottom, just before the last paragraph. Had this power originated in him? So Bill's asking himself the question. Had this power that Ebby's got, Ebby has a power. He's got a power that he's able to turn down the drink. Had this power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. Nobody knew Ebby better than Bill. Bill knew Ebby, and he knew that there was no way that the power could originate in Ebby. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was none at all. This is where Bill realizes that he was powerless. This is where Bill realizes that I have no power over this, and Ebby had no power over this. So where is this power coming from? We turn to, so this is basically the essence of step one. It's coming to the realization that I have no power. It's not originating in me. If there is a power, it's not coming from my own doing. Now, SA is not about lusting. And this is one of the things that I learned during the program, is I came into the program thinking my problem was lust. But my problem was never lust. I always thought lust is it, that's it. If I come into the program and I get rid of lust, that's it, finished, I'm done. Because I'm a great guy. I mean, I'm a wonderful guy. I've got great character traits. You know, really, really a real people pleaser. No problems with me. The only problem is I masturbate. That's it. But that's my problem. My problem is that lust was never my problem. My problem was my character defects. And step one is not about lusting. It's not about not lusting. If step one was all about lusting, then it would just say, quit, stop, that's it. It'd say, just don't lust. But I have to come to realize that I will lust no matter what. Why? Because I have no power. If I had the power to stay sober, I wouldn't need this program. So, question, do you really want to stop lusting? Or do you want to stop suffering? You see, if I offered every one of you on this call a way that you could lust to your heart's content, do whatever you like, watch whatever you like, and masturbate as much as you like, or even go out with prostitutes, have affairs, do whatever you want, and feel no pain. I can give you, imagine if I came to you today and I said, I can give you a way that you will feel no after effects, no bad taste in your mouth. You'll feel just fine. You'll have no consequences. How many of you would say, let's go? So it's not about just coming in and saying, just let me get rid of the lust. That's not what it's about. And I thought I needed more information in this program. I thought that's what's going to keep me sober. I just need more information. I wanted you to teach me little techniques. More information will keep me sober. That's what I thought. But all the information is worthless because I have no power. The question is, if I have no power, how manageable is my life going to be? The answer, probably pretty unmanageable. And that's where I started to realize that it's just not about me lusting. It's not just about that. It's also about the fact that my life is unmanageable. I came to the realization that I can't manage my life. And that's why in step one we say that it's not just about not lusting. It's that we admitted that we were powerless over lust and that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, if we turn to page 20, hold on one second. It says here, moderate drinkers, so it's bottom of the page, page 20, moderate lusters have little trouble in giving up lust entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. So there are guys out there that can watch porn, they can go out with prostitutes, they can even have affairs. But if they really wanted to, they can give it up. I mean, there are guys out there, believe it or not, that I believe actually masturbated more than I did. But they're not a sexaholic, because if they really wanted to stop, they could stop. I couldn't stop. So the Big Book is saying, the authors of the Big Book wants to make sure that if you are a sexaholic, you got to know that you are a real sexaholic. It says, then we have a certain type of hard luster. So there's a hard sexaholic, a hard drinker or hard luster. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may even cause him to die a few years before his time. But if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult. So in other words, there's even people out there, and it may be you, that you lust a lot. It seems almost like really, really hard to stop. But if you had a sufficient reason to stop, you will stop. In other words, if my wife caught me acting out and she said to me, if you act out again, if I catch you watching porn again, or if I catch you with someone again, I will leave you. Do you know what? I came to the realization that I would not be able to stop. It wouldn't help. I've put my family at risk. I've put my children at risk. I've put my wife at risk. And it's not enough to keep me sober. And that's what I've got to realize. I'm a real sexaholic. The next paragraph says, but what about the real sexaholic? He may even start off as a moderate sexaholic. He may or may not become a continuous sexaholic. But at some stage of his lusting career, he begins to lose all control of his lusting once he starts to lust. And that's what I had to come to realize, is I am a real sexaholic. Nothing can stop me from lusting. When I want to act out, nothing will get in my way. No matter what I can lose, and no matter what pain I go through. And that's where I think, if you're on this program and you're serious about finding out if you're a sexaholic, then the question is, will enough pain give you the reason to stop acting out? With enough pain, can you give up lust? Are you a real sexaholic? It's not about how much I act out, but it's whether I can choose to stop. And that's really the question I ask myself, is can I choose to stop? Page 23, paragraph 1. Now, this is where the authors of the Big Book talk about the mental obsession of this disease. We spoke about the physical craving. Now it talks about the mental obsession. By the way, for those of you that came on after we started, there will be questions at the end. So if anyone has questions on anything that I'm mentioning here, please do ask the questions at the end. And also, anything that I am saying is being quoted from the Big Book, so nothing here is originated from my own thoughts. So again, page 23, paragraph 1 says here, therefore, the main problem of the sexaholic centers in his mind. The authors are telling us, what are the authors telling us here, is that lust is not my problem. Lust is not my problem. My thinking is my problem. My mind has caused me more pain than anything else. Forget about lust. Lust was always my solution. My mind was my problem. It's caused me more suffering than anything else. And it's not about what's happened to me, but rather my mind's interpretation of what is happening. In other words, it doesn't matter about what's going on. It doesn't matter if my wife's in a bad mood or she's on her period. It doesn't matter if I'm in need and I can't have relations with my wife. It's not about whether I get sacked or fired from my job. It's not about my son's having a stroppy fit and I can't control the guy. And it's not about whether someone cut me off in the middle of the road and I'm annoyed with him. It's not about that. It's about my interpretation, my mind's interpretation of what's going on and how I interpret that and how I deal with that. And that's my problem. Page 24, in paragraph 1, it says, the fact is that most sexaholics, again, page 24, paragraph 1, the fact is that most sexaholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in lusting. We've lost the power of choice. Our so-called willpower, so they're basically making fun over here, so-called willpower. I thought I had willpower. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. In other words, what the authors are telling us here is it doesn't matter how much pain and suffering I've gone through, because the memory is not going to be enough to keep me sober. This paragraph reminds me of one time I acted out. And I actually, I basically had acted out in a way that I could get in serious trouble. Serious trouble. I was shaking with fear. I was on the floor in trepidation. I did not know what to do. I remember I called someone up in the program, and I shared with them, and I said to them, I'm literally dying of fear right now. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I'm scared. The consequence is this. And he said to me, do you want to know what's scary? Is that no matter how scared you are right now, it won't keep you sober. And those words stuck in my mind. And he was right, because literally less than 24 hours later, not more than 24 hours later, I was acting out again. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how scared I am, and it doesn't matter how humiliated I am, and it doesn't matter how much pain I'm in, it's not enough to keep me sober. Have you lost the power to choose? And that's the problem. It's that we just don't have the power to choose. Unless I'm constantly working with newcomers, I will act out. And in fact, this is for people who are maybe, you know, in the program for a long time, and maybe people who have double-digit sobriety. That unless I'm working with newcomers, unless I'm constantly being reminded, the memory of the suffering of even a week or month, that's what the big book says. It says, even a week or a month. Can you imagine if you're 20 years sober? Imagine you're 20 years sober. How much more so the suffering and the pain? It's going to be a distant, long time ago memory. That's not going to be enough to keep me sober. I need to be working with newcomers in the program, so it's constantly reminding me of where I was and what pain I went through. Page 34 in the big book, page 34, paragraph 2. It says here, for those who are unable to lust moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will lust or not. Now, can you stop on a non-spiritual basis? So the question is, if you want to know, in other words, if you want to know if you have taken the first step, just ask yourself the question, can you choose to not lust today? And the answer that I have is I do not choose not to lust today. I had no choice in not lusting today. Page 25, going back to page 25, paragraph 3. It says on page 25, last paragraph, if you are as seriously sexaholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, again, they're driving home the fact that there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. The authors are giving us a warning here. There is no middle-of-the-road solution. It's one way or the other way. And these are the two alternatives that I have. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. In other words, I can lust, I can keep acting out, and keep forgetting about the consequences, and keep going further and further, and suffering more and more. Or the other is to accept spiritual help. Are you willing to accept spiritual help? There are guys that I know, I mean, I'll speak for myself. When I was in the program at an early stage, I wanted the middle road solution. I didn't want to, completely do all the steps properly and have to surrender every single last hit and pray for every single, woman that I lusted after. I didn't want to work it fully. I just wanted to do a little bit of it. But it doesn't work like that. The authors are warning me here. If I really want to get better, if I want sobriety, then I need to accept spiritual help. And I need to work this program. And there are different levels of sobriety. And this is something that's actually quite funny. Something that Paul F. talks about is that there's a food chain in sobriety. There's a food chain. He says the bottom of the food chain is what's called peanut butter sobriety, right? So there's four levels of sobriety. There's peanut butter sobriety, which is at the bottom. There's hamburger sobriety. There's chicken sobriety. And then at the top, there's filet mignon sobriety, which I believe is a good steak, unless it's a fish. But it's definitely something very tasty. Peanut butter sobriety, it's the bottom level of sobriety. What's peanut butter sobriety? Peanut butter sobriety is like, it's like eating peanut butter, right? It gets stuck to the roof of your mouth, now it gets stuck in your teeth. In other words, it's very easy to get stuck there, right? If you want peanut butter sobriety, then, it's when you just sort of work the program just barely, I'm just about doing enough. Now, I'm not working the steps, I don't have a sponsor, I'm just sort of maybe going on the calls, maybe just listening in. But if I want peanut butter sobriety, then that's what I'm going to get. I'm going to stay stuck. Hamburger sobriety is a little bit better. Not much, but a little bit better. Then chicken sobriety is a little bit better than that. But then there's filet mignon sobriety, the steak. We get to the top of the food chain. Now, the question is, what do you want? Do you want peanut butter sobriety or do you want filet mignon sobriety? I personally want the best of the best. Why? Because I love my life today. Because I'm a free man. I don't suffer from the compulsion to lust. Most of the time I'm free from my head, the thing that's caused me more suffering than anything else. So I want the best of the best. I want to be able to have a free life. It's not enough that I'm just getting by and just staying dry and just about getting another day of, not acting out. That's not enough for me. I want the promises that this book gives me. I want the 12 promises. Freedom, the happy and joyous and free life. That's what I want. And now, the next part of the step one is unmanageability. If we look at page 52, again, we're still on step one. Page 52, second paragraph. It says here that we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. And by the way, living here doesn't necessarily mean money. Right? Making a living could just in terms of life, not managing life. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. So again, let's turn these into questions. I ask myself the question, are you having trouble with personal relationships? Can you control your feelings? Are you subject to misery and depression? Can you make a living? Again, this doesn't have to do with making money. Do you feel useless at times? Are you full of fear? Are you unhappy? Step one tells me I have no power and I need a new manager. I cannot manage my life. Page 36, bottom of the page. Page 36, bottom of the page. He says here, the authors say, he had much knowledge about himself as a sexaholic. Yet all reasons for not lusting were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could, it says here, take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Now, the way I read this is that, yeah, well, you know, I can go online and look at a few images and I just won't masturbate. You know, I'll just look at the images. That's, you know, the authors are saying here, it's a foolish idea. Why am I going in and going and looking at these images, thinking that I'm going to not masturbate? So, oh, that's okay. I'm still sober. But I'm fooling myself. I'm fooling myself because that's not true sobriety. I'm not going to get the gift of a free, happy, and joyous life. And then page 39, line 5. But the actual or potential sexaholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable, and he puts this in italics. Whenever the big book puts things into italics, we know that it's very, very important. So again, but the actual or potential sexaholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop lusting on the basis of self-knowledge. So again, I ask myself a question. Can I stop lusting on the basis of self-knowledge? See, again, I used to think that all I needed was more information. I just needed more information and then I'll stay sober. Just give me another good tip. But it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. And in fact, on page 30, paragraph 2, the authors reinstate this. It says, paragraph 2, on page 30, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were sexaholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. This paragraph is the essence of step one. This is what the authors are telling me is how I know that I've taken step one. This is the way to take step one, is I have to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm a sexaholic. And that fact that I'm like other people has to be smashed. I'm not like other people. And in fact, it's suggested that a person, once he's gone through the first step, that he should go home and he should sit with himself and ask himself the question, am I willing to concede to my innermost self that I have no power and that I need a new manager? And if I'm saying yes, that means that I'm saying the following. I'm saying that, number one, I had an abnormal reaction to lust. That's number one. I have an abnormal reaction to lust. Number two is that, yes, I did experience the phenomenon of craving. Number three is that no sufficient reason is enough to keep me sober. Number four is that I lost all control once I start to lust. I lose all control. The minute I start to lust, I lose all control. And number five is I've lost the power to choose whether I will lust or not. And as long as I cling to the idea that I have some knowledge or some power or some information or some memory that's going to keep me sober, there's no room to move to step two. I cannot move to step two unless I think, even a little bit, that I have some knowledge that can help me, or I have some power that can help me, or I have some information that can help me, or some memory. If I have any thoughts of that, that's going to keep me sober, I can't move to step two. Because what does step two say? Step two says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. If I came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, that means that I have no power to restore myself to sanity. I have to believe fully that a power greater than myself. And in fact, on page 46, the last paragraph on page 46, it says that as soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, so talking about God here, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. In other words, they're giving us some hope. You see, until now, I've been reading all these problems that we've got. I've talked about the craving, the phenomenon of craving. We've talked about the unmanageability. It's depressing, right? Step one is depressing. Because, if I went into a doctor surgeon and he said, I'm sorry, you've got no control over this disease. It's uncontrollable. Well, thank you very much. Yippity-doo-dah. You know, I'm not happy. That doesn't make me feel good. So that's why the authors of the book come on page 46 and say, but here's your first look at hope. As soon as I'm able to admit the possible existence of a higher power, of a God that basically runs the whole universe, then I'm able to possess a new sense of power and direction, provided that we take other simple steps. So the authors are telling us, don't worry, because if you take a few simple steps with the knowledge that God is in control, then you're guaranteed, this is a guarantee, this is a promise, that you're going to have a new sense of power and direction. I can honestly say, I'm only speaking for myself, and I'm sure David Chaim, and I'm sure that other people on this call who have worked this program and have tasted freedom, they can honestly say wholeheartedly that they have a new sense of power and direction in life. Who couldn't want such a thing? I can't even think of all the money in the world that I would spend to buy such a thing. We're actually at the end of step one. I'm going to stop the recording.